Grace to you and peace. In 1802, the Danbury Baptist Association of Connecticut wrote to President Thomas Jefferson, telling him that in Connecticut, the Congregational Church had established themselves as the official religion, and they, as Baptists, were not being allowed to freely practice their faith. It was only done as a favor and on occasion. In response to that letter, President Jefferson wrote one of the most famous pieces of our early American history, a piece that I think we mostly misunderstand. Referring to the First Amendment, he talked specifically about the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. He said there shouldn't be no establishment of religion in these, our United States, and there should be nothing that impinges upon the free exercise thereof, putting between them a wall of separation. That's the part I don't think we understand. I think, in fact, over the course of the last 200 years, we've almost entirely turned Jefferson's intent for what that is and how we understand that. It's also not in any legal document of the United States. Not in our Constitution, not adopted into any amendments. Do you know whose it is in? This is an interesting thing. This phrase exactly is in the Constitution of the Soviet Union. Isn't that interesting? See, what Jefferson meant to say, I really believe, is bring the fullness of your faith to politics. Be who you are as people of God in your public life. Let it affect how you enter the polling place. Bring how you understand the teachings of Jesus into all that you do. But our country should not impact how it is that we believe or practice those religions. It stands firmly in the footsteps of Martin Luther, who believed that we needed to do exactly that, be people of God in public life. And I think today, it's mostly turned on its head and misunderstood. Now, it may seem uniquely American, this notion that church and state would be separate as we think about old Europe and that, but I want to tell you, it's not. It's not. That it was first the Gospel of Luke who said that our faith ought show up in our politics. It started right at the beginning of what we read today. There's a Latin word in there. It's a weird word. But the place that they took Jesus to be crucified, it was not Golgotha in Luke, but the place of the skull in Latin. That is to say, it's the place where the Romans took the Jews to execute them, to torture them, and for them to die. The place of empire and power in its grossest excess. And in the case of this moment, the reaction of the people, and in English this is really broad, right? Everybody who might be there. But the Greek is the word for the faithful people. It's the word that we get for laity, which is everybody who's not a pastor. All of the faithful people, the ones who knew better, or should have, they stood there doing nothing, only watching. Only watching. And what were they watching? But the death of their king. The one that they had waited for, it doesn't matter if you call him Messiah or Chosen One or King of the Jews. This is the one who you have waited for together as people of God. And you stood by watching. So, what does it mean to be king? What was it that the people allowed to happen there? What is Luke trying to help them understand? Well, do you remember when we first heard prepare the way of the Lord in the Gospel of Luke? It's chapter 3. John the Baptist, having come from the wilderness across the Jordan, says, "Prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight." He stands on Mary's work in Luke chapter 1, where she said that the world is being turned right side up by God, that God is doing the work of lifting up the lowly and giving them a place among God's faithful. All of that is echoes of Isaiah, a time period when the people were so lost in the wilderness they did not have hope, when the people were so scattered amongst Babylon and that empire that they didn't know which way was home. And if they did, it was too far. The road was too covered with thieves and bandits to begin to even think about making that journey back to that place. They had no future. They had no hope. Until God spoke to them in chapter 36. It was then that God said, "You don't have to go the long way. You don't have to go to the way that is populated by thieves and bandits. Instead, I will make a way that is straight for you in the wild place, the desert, the place of chaos and uncertainty, fear and doubt. I'm going to plow right through that. And I'm going to build for you a road that is big enough and wide enough that everyone who is afraid can fit shoulder to shoulder and make that journey to the promised land. In the desert, you say, we'll die certainly of thirst, and there are too many who are infirm. We can't take all the weak and the vulnerable, the people who need help. How could we possibly make our way there?" God said to them again, "Let me take care of it. I will make the desert blossom. I will provide for you rivers of life. I will provide for you a way where there is none." A wide road, you say, God. A wide road that will lead us directly back to the place of holiness, where your finger touches the ground, keeping the earth spinning on its axis, where the temple once stood, where hope had no bounds and sprung forth like a stream from under the throne of the Almighty. That one, oh God? You're going to do that? It's that hope that Luke said we stood by and watched. And it's dangerous, I know, to begin to say, hey, let's talk about politics in church. But the gospel is necessarily political. And I think the fear is that we will tell you it must be done a certain way. That picture on the right, you worry about us saying, you're going to have to go that way, right? But what I want you to hear today is that sitting out, as I look at this room, some of the very most progressive people I have ever encountered are sitting here. And so are the most wonderfully conservative folks. You're sitting next to each other, unified by a single truth. Christ is your King. It's the vision that Paul had for Corinth and Galatia and Ephesus, and it is the truth of who we are as Spirit of Joy. That what brings us together is not outside of these walls, but inside of us and inside of God's good news. That we are people of God, the faithful ones. And the call to us is that we cannot stand by doing nothing. So if you choose to protest, I support that right. I believe it's written into the governing documents of our United States, and we should uphold it and protect it. If you are a person who says, what I can do is feed people. Do that where you are and how you are. If, like me, you're a pen-to-paper person, put your pen to your paper. Show up, go to the ballot box, bring your faith with you. If, like me, you worry about our country and the loss, the erosion of civil discourse, that so many of us have had friends who we no longer can talk to, family members with whom relationships are broken? Find a way. Find a way to sit and look in the eyes of the people you love, because you do love them. I love them. I love you. And have the conversation. Grant the respect and the dignity, and hold the place of Christ between you. And if none of that can happen, pray. Pray again and again and again. Pray without ceasing. Pray with sighs too deep for words to express. Our gospel is political. Luke looked at those who, to whom he was writing, and he said to them, "You knew. You were the faithful ones who knew. And you stood by and did nothing while the empire killed our king." We must do better. God's vision for us is a way through all of our fears and our doubts, our uncertainty, that is wide enough for everyone, that is overflowing with life, that is hopeful for each and every person in our world. The gospel is political. And Luke says, "You faithful ones, it's time. Do something." Amen.